I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, June 9th, how the uprising in America has moved to rural towns and small to mid-sized cities.
If you think of your state and you think of the one place where you'd never think there would be a protest, there is a very good chance that there has been a protest there.
Plus, how kids learn about race means a world of difference in how they act.
So if they don't have friends of color coming over, then they never see their parents interact with them, and they may just assume that, well, I guess my parents don't like them, or they just don't know.
And you're still angry, and we're listening to you.
I'm angry about how fractured our country has become under the influence of our current administration. How do I deal with it? After work, I go out for a bike ride and blow some steam off. Occasionally, I swear at the radio.
But first, over the weekend, the nation's capital saw its biggest protest yet against police brutality. Tens of thousands of people marched in D.C. to demand justice for George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, and many other black people who've been killed by police in the United States. But these largely peaceful protests aren't just happening in D.C. and other major metro cities like New York, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia. Protests are also happening in mid-sized cities like Portland, Maine, and Wilmington, North Carolina, and even in really small towns like Millerton, New York, where a lone protester stood with a Black Lives Matter sign.
No peace! No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No
peace!
And our next guest says we should take note, especially because of what this could tell us about the future of organized protest. Anne Helen Peterson is a culture writer for BuzzFeed News who's been tracking protests in small cities and towns around the country, and she joins us now from her home in Missoula, Montana. Anne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with Montana. How have protests been playing out there, Anne? Are they expanding to bigger cities like Billings?
Oh, yeah. There's a massive protest in Billings. I mean, it's our big city. It's over 100,000 people. But it's, you know, the protests have also been all over in Missoula, which is pretty expected because we're a college town, but also in Butte, in Hamilton, in Havre, which is a small ag town, in Lewistown, Montana. Like, they really are all over.
We mentioned at the top of the show we were used to seeing protests in large cities like New York and D.C., but what are some of the surprising places that we're seeing smaller protests playing out in smaller towns, Anne?
You know, I think if you think of your state and you think of the one place in that state where you'd never think there would be a protest, there is a very good chance that there has been a protest there. So that includes places that are known for their racism all over the South. That includes pretty white bread conservative suburbs. And that includes like tiny little ag towns like Pinedale, Wyoming.
I want to talk about who is at these protests, because there's a couple things playing out here. We see one of the things that's emerged this time around is that we're seeing much more, at least in New York and other places, we're seeing a lot of diversity among the protesters themselves. They are not just black protesters, but we see white protesters, protesters of color, gender diversity among them. I'm wondering if that's what's also playing out in towns where black populations are smaller than they are in New York. Are we seeing majority white protests, for example?
Yeah, in a lot of these places, there are maybe only a handful of black people that live there. And I think one thing that a lot of the organizers in these places have done very well is center those voices whenever possible. And that includes, you know, Native people, if that's the representation of people of color who are in the area, because Native people absolutely experience police profiling and racism, and especially in these towns that are close to reservations. But yeah, there you look out and you'll see a lot of white faces. And, you know, there are many ways that you can try to explain this. One is when the Black Lives Matter movement first really started gaining traction in 2015, you know, most of America still didn't have much of a protest tradition. This was before Trump's election. And a number of things after Trump's election encouraged people to maybe protest for the first time. And now you're seeing more of that energy coalesce around Black Lives Matter this time.
And I would argue that most of America, I think that it also breaks down around generational lines. I think, you know, our boomer parents, for example, get criticized a lot, but their generation was largely protesting. And I think, you know, you mentioned Black Lives Matter, that there were a lot of actions around the country, largely driven by Black protesters. I'm wondering, Anne, are we seeing an organized effort to create these protests, or are these sort of spontaneous grassroots actions that are happening?
I think it's a real mix. You know, I talked to someone in a small town who, you know, he and his handful of friends were like, let's just go downtown and we'll kneel and hold signs. And they didn't realize until afterwards that another group in their small town, this is like, you know, a town of 25,000 or something, was doing the exact same thing three blocks away. So sometimes it's like that. And then sometimes it's organized by high school students who have been at the front of a lot of these protests. And, you know, I've talked to some of them, and I think that one thing that we're seeing a lot of is that they saw through the March for Our Lives movement that this is something that they can do in their schools and that they can take the lead on and make possible.
A lot of the protests that we're seeing across the country, particularly in larger cities here in New York, we're now going on 2 weeks of sustained daily protests. Are many of the protests that we're seeing in smaller cities and mid-sized cities and rural towns, as you mentioned, are they one-day actions largely, or is there sort of a sustained momentum to them?
I think in some places they're one day, but then in other places like Sandpoint, Idaho, which is a town of under 20,000 people, they've been protesting for 4 days. And some of them are a little bit smaller, and then I think they grow bigger on the weekends. And you see this also in a place like Laramie, Wyoming. So I think it depends on the organizers. Here in Missoula, every single day you can drive downtown and see protesters. And then there are days where there's more organized action as well.
We often talk a lot about the era of surveillance that we're living in. And even though, this is an issue with protests that we've seen crop up in Hong Kong, for example, that protesters are surveilled and potentially tracked. And it's something that we're interested in talking about on the show. But more broadly, if you protest in a city like a large city, you can sort of get lost in the crowd, right? I'm wondering if in smaller protests that we're seeing, there are different risks. Are people, you know, if you're in a small town where, quote unquote, everybody knows your name, what effect does that have?
Yeah, this is something that I think is maybe difficult to understand if you've never lived in a small town. But if you have lived in a small town, you just absolutely get it. And that is that being very visible as part of a protest, especially if it's one that involves, you know, being on a street corner and holding signs, that will stick with you for the rest of your life in that town. You will always be a person who protested. And I think that's also why, you know, we get a mix of high school students who maybe haven't figured out exactly how that will stick with them for the rest of their lives, or older people who just don't care anymore, or other people of all ages who, again, think this is worth it. Like, I am deciding to stand up and say that Black Lives Matter, and I don't care how other people gossip about me.
I'm thinking about, we mentioned a lone protester at the top of the show. I'm thinking about another lone protester in Florida, an older white woman who was holding a sign that said Black Lives Matter. When we see those individuals, what is the importance there? I mean, what does that tell that community?
I think even just having one person stand up and say, this matters to me, that visibility is so important for other people in the community. You know, in some of these small towns, there's a belief that there's no one who maybe believes the same thing as you do, right? Whether that's progressive beliefs, social justice beliefs, that sort of thing. And people are just kind of quiet about it. But sometimes all it takes is that one person, like in Florida, the 80-year-old woman who's saying, like, you know what, screw this, this is important, and I'm going to stand up.
Let's talk a little bit about the response to protests on both sides of the spectrum here. We can talk a little bit about whether or not counter protests are popping up. Are you seeing that with these smaller protests?
Yeah, and it's complicated. I think in some places you do get on the fringe a little bit of the Blue Lives Matter or All Lives Matter, or just people with Trump flags just holding up the flag kind of to troll the protesters. And then you also get people who don't necessarily consider themselves counter-protesters, but who have internalized this rumor that has been fanned by President Trump that Antifa is coming to these protests to, you know, burglarize or loot downtown. And so they show up in a sort of show of force in order to protect the downtown. Most of the time, they do not think that the protesters themselves are going to loot. It's more that they think that there are these roving bands of Antifa that are coming.
What about the police? How have the police responded in these smaller communities? Again, sort of thinking back to in small towns, people are much more familiar with each other. They might even know some of the police. So are we seeing police responses to smaller protests?
Yeah, it's a mix. I think, you know, there's a town, I believe in Louisiana, where they instituted a curfew in part because those rumors of Antifa coming had become so powerful that they had made their way to the mayor's office. And that curfew was for 7 p.m. And so some of the high school students who were involved in this protest were like, you know what? I'm staying past 7 p.m. And five students were arrested. So you do have some pushback in that capacity. In other places, you have, you know, police kneeling as well or participating or speaking at the march. I think a lot of it depends on the relationship of the organizer to the police and in some ways the character of the protest. But then in some places, you know, the woman who organized the protest in Havre, Montana, she is a Native woman, Chippewa Cree, and she said that she reached out to the police department to be part of, you know, this conversation and to be out on the streets with them, and they declined.
And what do you think this movement of smaller protests
is that are working towards justice? So I think all of this really, really matters.
Anne Helen Peterson is a culture writer for BuzzFeed News. Anne, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we'd love to know if your small city or town is protesting. Tell us what it's like. You can call us and leave a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The uprisings around the country have kept three names in the public discourse: George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor. But beyond protests in the streets, each of these cases is also playing out in the legal system. The four officers who killed George Floyd have been arrested and charged. The three men who participated in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery have also been arrested and charged. And the FBI has launched an investigation into the killing of Breonna Taylor. Paul Butler is here to explain where each of these cases stands today. Paul is a professor of law at Georgetown University, a former prosecutor, and the author of Chokehold: Policing Black Men. Paul, great to have you back with us.
Hey, Tanzina. It's great to be here.
The Ahmaud Arbery case is currently in court. What have we learned so far about the men who were involved?
Last week, there was very graphic testimony at a hearing where three men appear to have chased Mr. Arbery, essentially hunted him down. We learned that not only was he shot, he was also hit with the truck. And shortly after he expired, or actually probably while he was dying, he was called the N-word by one of his assailants.
Let's turn to Breonna Taylor's case, Paul. It's being investigated by the FBI. Now, what we understand is that the officers who were involved in Breonna's case and her killing have not yet been arrested. So tell us a little bit about why the FBI has gotten involved and yet the officers involved are still haven't been arrested.
There have been major concerns about the effectiveness of the Louisville Police Department. There have been high-profile incidences in which their body cams should have been on, and they were not. We know that when police officers are suspected of misconduct, they have a lot of privileges that other suspects wouldn't have. And so it may be that because of these protections that they frequently win through collective bargaining, that the police department doesn't have all of the information that it needs.
We are also very aware as a country about George Floyd's death. This is a death that has reverberations internationally at this point. Many of us have seen the horrific video. The four officers involved have now been arrested and charged. Paul, what do you make of the charges right now where they stand? We know the first police officer who was arrested, who had his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck, those charges have now been increased to second degree murder from what we understand.
Yeah, so that's a former officer, Clavin. He has the book thrown at him. He's charged with second degree murder, third degree murder, and manslaughter. The prosecution has a tough case, despite what we've all seen on videotape. The fact is that most police officers who are charged with murder end up walking. The charges are dismissed or a jury finds them not guilty. Somewhere between 100, 150 officers have been charged with murder, only 10 murder convictions. So it may be with the array of charges against this first officer that the prosecution is looking either for a compromised verdict from the jurors. They might not find him guilty of second degree murder, which is a 40-year sentence, but maybe third degree murder, which carries a 25-year sentence. And it may be that the prosecution is trying to strengthen its case if someone wants to make a deal. So, for example, one of the other three officers who's charged with aiding and abetting might agree to testify in favor of the prosecution. That person might get a deal.
Paul, particularly in the case of George Floyd, we know that there have been sustained protests so far, at least for 2 weeks in the United States, invoking George Floyd as sort of the turning point here. How much of a role did protests and uprising, this uprising we're seeing across the United States, play in Attorney General Keith Ellison's decision and others to increase and change the charges against Officer Chauvin and also charge and arrest the remaining three officers in the case of Floyd?
So we know that the day after Mr. Floyd was killed, the four officers were discharged from the force. But in a press conference, the district attorney said he wasn't sure there was enough evidence to charge anyone with a crime. He said, based on the video, he saw evidence that laid in favor of charging, but he also suggested that there was other evidence that suggested that charges weren't appropriate. The protests started immediately, and then within 4 days, the first officer was arrested. There was concern by the family and the community that the third degree murder charges didn't reflect the gravity of the crime. And there was also concern that the other three officers still hadn't been charged. So massive protests happened all over the United States, indeed all over the world. And then last week, we learned that Attorney General Ellison, an African-American former congressman, had been selected to lead the case, and that the charges against the first officer had been upgraded to second-degree murder, and that the other three officers were charged with aiding and abetting murder, which carries the same 40-year sentence as murder.
Paul, a couple things that are happening at the policy level, at least. There was a federal bill, I believe, that was passed making lynching a federal crime. It's only taken hundreds of years to do that. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm thinking about Emmett Till. He was the 14-year-old child who was lynched in Mississippi in 1955. He was an African-American who was alleged to have whistled at a white woman. His mother decided to leave the casket open, she said, so they could see, the world could see what they had done to him. It was a very graphic image. It was graphic in the way that the 10-minute video of George Floyd's suffering and death is graphic. The Emmett Till pictures broadcast all over the world galvanized a civil rights movement. Rosa Parks went to a rally for Emmett Till, and Parks, a seasoned activist herself, soon after refused to move in that bus in Montgomery, Alabama. So the hope is that these graphic images of Mr. Floyd's killing will also galvanize a movement and lead to some constructive reform, like what we're seeing from Congress, this justice bill of 2020.
I'd like to talk a little bit about those reforms, because when we see the killing of George Floyd, many people remember the killing of Eric Garner at the hands of police officers here in New York City a couple of years ago. And both of these gentlemen, Eric Garner was killed essentially with the chokehold. There is talk of chokehold reform. I'm wondering if there's also talk of reforming the move that was used against Mr. Floyd on his neck. Paul, do we know where police departments stand with their use of physical force right now?
So the problem with police reform is that there are 18,000 different police departments in the United States, and there are 18,000 different ways of policing. What Congress would do with this Justice Act of 2020 is to establish some national requirements which with regard to the use of force. And they're going to use the power of the purse. Police departments get a lot of money from the federal government. From now on, this money is going to come with conditions if the act is passed, including a rule that police officers could only use deadly force as a last result. They'd have to engage in de-escalation. And if they can resolve the situation without resulting to killing a person, that would be required. Incredibly, that's not the law right now.
And many of these incidents, as we know, have been caught on video, which has really changed people's perception about when these uses of force are implemented. Paul Butler, professor of law at Georgetown University, former prosecutor and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Paul, thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll join us again sometime.
Always a pleasure, Tanzina.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This week, we've been asking you to tell us what's making you angry in this moment. And you responded in a big way, venting rage, frustration, and even sadness that goes alongside it. Yesterday, we aired a number of these voicemails, and since then, the calls just keep coming. So many of you are saying, I'm angry, I'm hurting, and here's why. So we want to give voice to more of you today. Let's take a listen.
This is Terry from the rural left coast. You ask if we're angry. Yes. I'm angry about how fractured our country has become under the influence of our current administration. How do I deal with it? After work, I go out for a bike ride and blow some steam off. Occasionally, I swear at the radio.
My name is Rose, and I'm from Pittsburgh, PA. I'm angry that I didn't realize how bad the racism is in our country. I'm grateful for COVID-19 that shed a light on the corruption, the aggressors, and the victims. The only good thing that has come out of our abomination of a president is that his racism has ignited into this tipping point where change must happen.
My name is Bobby, and I'm calling from Crescent, Texas. I'm just so thankful to live in this country that we live in. Lord knows it's not perfect. I'm a black male, and I can tell you that, especially in the area that I live in, I don't feel very welcome sometimes. But there are people and places that I probably live lives that I can only imagine that are much worse. So I'm thankful. There's a lot of anger right now, but it'll dissipate. I'm just thankful that people are listening.
My name is Tom. I'm calling from San Marcos, California. I'm a 74-year-old man, white, grown up in privilege, who has never expressed publicly anything about my feelings about injustice. And reading posts in things like Nextdoor, which is a community posting service, and hearing that people are still saying, oh, but cops are okay, this is not right to be angry with cops. And I'm angry because I don't know what to do. I don't know any black people. And yet I'm enraged by what our so-called president is doing to this country and to this world.
Melissa McCormick, Lincolnton, North Carolina. My voice is gone. I'm a Caucasian woman, and my voice is gone because Black Lives Matter. I am disgusted by the racism in my hometown, and the death of George Floyd has sparked division in the hearts of people that were already divided from their fellow Americans. But this is a turning point. And even in my own marriage, I'm seeing racism that I don't think I even knew existed to the degree in which it's there. I think this is opening a lot of people's eyes to the people around us that we thought we knew. And Black lives matter. All lives matter. And this change needed to be made.
My name is Stephanie Traversy, and I am a Standing Rock Sioux Indian who lives in Watertown, South Dakota. My heart is broken by the loss of George Floyd and so many other Black and brown men, women, and children in this country. I would really, really like to know that when the changes are going to take effect, that it will also happen here in South Dakota. It seems like South Dakota is the last state in the country to ever change or to even make moves in any one direction. And so while my heart is broken, I am definitely determined to position myself to help in effecting change in this state any way that I can. I just worry a lot about us being behind.
My name is Phyllis Elliott, and I'm from Santa Monica, California. I am appalled, ashamed, and outraged, as is everyone around the world, about the current events. But I also am hopeful that this time will be different. When I look out into the streets, and I look also into the emergency rooms and the markets and the post offices, I am seeing a great generation arise. God bless them, and God help us.
Thanks for venting to us. We always do our best to listen to every single call that comes in, even those that don't make it on air. And if you haven't had a chance to weigh in, please give us a call. The number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. We are here to listen. This past weekend, as protests against racial injustice continued across the country, the movement also made its way onto a street that's familiar to kids everywhere.
They look upset. Are the protesters sad?
They are sad and upset, and they have every right to be, Elmo. People are upset because racism is a huge problem in our country.
Racism? What's that?
That was Elmo talking with his dad as part of a Sesame Street special broadcast on CNN. But while Elmo's dad was comfortable addressing racism with his child, many parents in the United States are not. A 2019 study from Sesame Workshop surveyed parents of kids ages 3 through 12 and found that only around 10% talked frequently with their children about race. White parents were more than 3 times less likely than Black parents to say they brought up race often with their kids. So today, while more white parents might finally want to have these conversations with their children, they don't necessarily know where to start. So we have 2 guests who have thought a lot about teaching kids about race. Jessica Bratt is the Youth Services Manager at Grand Rapids Public Library in Michigan. Jessica, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Bridget Vitrup, Professor of Childhood Development at Texas Women's University. Bridget, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Bridget, we just heard that white parents talk to their kids about race at a rate much lower than Black parents. Why?
So a lot of white adults have grown up not being used to talking about it ever since the end of the civil rights movement. There has been this ideology of colorblindness where we shouldn't see color, we shouldn't talk about it, because that way, hopefully, we won't discriminate against people. The problem is that society is not colorblind. Children are not colorblind. But I think oftentimes part of the problem is that these parents are just not used to talking about it. And for white parents, a lot of parents I've talked to, they want their children to be colorblind. They're afraid that if they start talking about race, they're going to point out something that their children haven't seen or haven't noticed yet. or they assume their children have no biases, and also just being uncomfortable, not really knowing what to say, afraid of saying the wrong thing. There's a stereotype about white people being racist, so they're worried, what if I say the wrong thing? Somebody's going to think I'm racist. So there's a lot of factors that go into that.
I'm wondering, Bridget, also, we know that here in our country, oftentimes our social circles are very segregated, right? We may work with Black people and other people of color, but we don't necessarily spend our private time with them. Does that also have a role in the white parents in particular being uncomfortable talking about race? The fact that, you know, at home there aren't other, their own social circles are not very diverse.
White people that live in mostly white neighborhoods and have gone to mostly white schools, because white is the majority race in the United States, it's a lot less salient. So you can be white and don't have to walk around every day being reminded of the fact that you are white. So it's not, it just isn't as present on people's minds. And neighborhoods today are actually more segregated than they were back around the time of Brown versus Board of Education. And because schools, kids go to schools in the neighborhoods they live in, the schools are very segregated too.
Jessica, I'm curious, what are some of the questions that children tend to have for their parents about race?
A lot of kids are wondering from the very beginning, why does this person have a different color skin? I get a lot of kids who want to explore, why does this person have physical features? And for the older kids around 6 to 8, they may notice that this child speaks differently, or this child eats a different food that I'm not accustomed to. And so they have a lot of basic questions around cultural differences and physical differences. And a lot of times parents are afraid to engage in that.
And is that mainly because, again, they're not exposed to those differences in their daily lives? I would imagine if, for example, if you're talking about kids in big cities, that there might be a little bit more exposure.
A lot of times parents assume that there's this osmosis effect, that they can put their child in a diverse setting, and somehow in that setting, the kid will be open and they will have worked out any type of racial tension that may arise. They won't have any biases, conscious or unconscious, just by being around kids of color. Yet the studies and even talking with kids, that isn't true. They just make assumptions, a lot of times harmful assumptions. And depending on the trauma that the kid of color may go through when they're pointing it out and saying, well, why are you eating that weird food? Or why are you, you know, why is your skin like this? It perpetuates stereotypes all over again.
And Bridget, I'm wondering, does that fear and reluctance, or just, you know, insecurity on the part of white parents hurt their children by not talking about race?
Yes, unfortunately, parents that try to take the colorblind perspective are well-intended. But the problem is that silence is a very big message, because kids are noticing all of these differences. And so if we don't talk about it, it's almost as saying, well, these people aren't important. It's not important to talk about. It's okay that we have all this social inequality, so we're just not going to address it. And what's interesting is that I did a study where we asked children actually about their parents' attitudes. These were all white children, asked them very simple questions about whether or not their parents like Black people. Would they be okay with you playing with a Black friend? And quite a few kids either said flat out, no, I don't think they like Black people, or they said, I don't know. Because if they, like you said, even if they might have Black coworkers that they interact with at work, the kids don't see that. And so if they don't have friends of color coming over, then they never see their parents interact with them, and they don't have any conversations. So they may just assume that, well, I guess my parents don't like them, or they just don't know. And that can influence their development of racial biases.
Jessica, I'm curious about how this is playing out in this moment in particular? Because I think we can ignore, if you will, and I'm putting ignore in big air quotes here, we can ignore race, right? If we live in segregated communities, if we are not interacting often, if the media that we consume, you know, is also lacking diversity, you can sort of get by it. But we're in a moment right now where, because of the pandemic, all of us are, many of us are still home or sheltering in place to a certain extent. Our lives have been upended. And on top of that, we are dealing with a moment, a movement in this country for racial justice that will not be ignored. So what is this moment where we can't ignore race anymore due to these conversations, Jessica?
It allows not just the conversation, but it empowers it for me that this is a need that has been the elephant in the room far too long. And so by a lot of white families being able to live in this safety bubble and sort of look the other way and not have to deal with leaning into this discomfort, this movement has pushed it now to their front door, where you will not be able to look away and you will have to commit to something, whether that is committing to doing the work, whether that's the self-work on figuring out what biases that you have, how you may not have been taught to think about race, and allow yourself the space to develop these muscles so you can go forward making sure that you are modeling and teaching inclusion, especially talking about race with your kid. It's forcing you to sort of make that decision. Am I going to draw the line in the sand and say that I'm still going to continuously be colorblind and have this myth that we live in a post-racial society, or am I going to actually do the work to make sure that I just don't hope for the best for my kids, or say that, you know, I want the next generation to be better, yet you're reeling that I've heard from a lot of parents, like, I thought this was, you know, in the 60s, I can't believe this is happening again. Or will you actually commit to a future that we have not yet experienced together in being and doing anti-racist work?
But that also, I think that also sort of begs I wouldn't say the question, but I think it also illuminates the fact that there's just been a lack of understanding of what Black communities and more extensively communities of color have dealt with in this country. For a lot of Black people and non-Black people of color, there's this, I think, recognition that this has been brewing for a while. For white families to say, oh, we didn't know that this was going to happen, or we're so surprised, doesn't that also indicate a lack of historical understanding, Jessica?
Oh, 100%. So cultural identity is important, right? It gives kids a sense of belonging. It helps self-esteem. And yet we don't embrace cultural identity in a cross-cultural way. We say that the cultural norm is whiteness. And I'm saying that in air quote, but this is the experience that is normal, and anything else is sort of others. And you know, we don't really embrace that. And you look at, to me, the pinnacle of that was Drew Brees, and the fact that a lot of times white people make these statements that are centered in the erasure of a shared history, of shared cultures. So I look at the fact that when kids see themselves in history, a lot of times in school, they only see themselves through slavery. A lot of times is when they meet themselves. So you're seeing like white achievements throughout the whole course of history, and yet you're never giving any context around colonization, the achievements that happen with Black history before even arriving to America. A lot of times you only see that there's one type of cowboy. You look at other cultures, a lot of times Asian Americans get a snippet around internment camp. And so you're sort of reinforcing this narrative that there's only whiteness that has built and sustained America, instead of showing that there are so many great achievements that made America what it was, shameful and affirming in a celebratory way of people that were able to achieve when they didn't have much to, or a lot of obstacles in the way. And so I feel like then you only celebrate, you designate these months that a lot of times for white parents, they only engage and only participate during these themed heritage months. And then they think that's it.
I would also say that they oftentimes the conversations around Black History Month, for example, Hispanic Heritage Month, they're often highlighting folks like Martin Luther King and sort of a more peaceful peaceful form of protest, if you will. And right now we're seeing quite something that's quite powerful happening around the country. Jessica, how did your own parents talk to you about race when you were growing up? Did they talk to you about race?
Sure. So I always tell people that I was raised by like ex-Black Panthers, right? So they were the first, their short story was they grew up during segregation. My dad was born in 46, my mom 49. They followed the Great Migration. They were the first in their family to go and to finish college. And they wanted to make sure that we had a sense of pride in school. My mom immediately was affected by the doll study that was the height during her time in school with Brown versus Board. And she was so scared that we wouldn't be proud of ourselves and we would only consume the negative and the images portrayed in the media and the biases. So they a lot of times were not graceful, as I say, with introducing us to race. I always talk about like my dad at 9 was like, we have to watch Amistad. Like this is this is your history. And I just remember being super traumatized, being like, that's so intense.
Right. it's a lot. It's a lot for 9. Yeah.
and so that's how... that's just how my parents treated race. They were just in your face. Like, I don't want you to be surprised when kids don't want to play with you or don't want to go to your birthday party or say that you live in a bad neighborhood.
So I want to bring that up to Bridget also, because I think what we're talking about here, and Jessica, to your point, this idea that Black children in this country are, you seem to have a sense of humor about it, but I mean, there really is a difference in how Black children are made aware, whether they want to be made aware or not, of the dangers of being Black in this country. At a very young age. And we've often talked about the talk, right? The talk that mm-hmm. Black parents have with their Black children, particularly if they're Black men, Black boys. And white children seem to be able to escape that for quite some time. And so, Bridget, I'm wondering if you can help us understand how what effect that has, right? And the fact that Black children are hyper aware of race and the fear that surrounds that. And white children are often shielded from that until moments like now.
I think what it does is, for one thing, when children of color are made aware of this, it influences their self-esteem, their development, their identity. And for parents, it's especially Black parents, they do it in order to protect their children, that you have to be aware of this. And from very early on, they learn that they are being perceived based on their race. But then there's nobody talking about it. Like, they go to school, they're surrounded by teachers and white peers that don't have these conversations. And so it almost silences them. It trivializes their voices and their opportunity to express how they're feeling, almost as if they have to be ashamed of it or that nobody cares or nobody knows. And so that affects them as well. So it's not just that you have white children growing up not being able to talk about this and maybe start developing biases because of everything they're exposed to in the media and the structural division that they see in society. It's also that the children of color are just overlooked and ignored, and that influences them in a negative way.
We're seeing, some of the news channels creating kids' news channels, right, to really try to explain, here's a daily kids' news report to kind of help children understand the moment that we're in. How effective, Jessica, are these forms of media? How well do you think an Elmo special on CNN, you know, about racism of all things, is received? And how effective is that?
I always say it's a start. A lot of times parents are open to figuring out how they can have age-appropriate conversations. I don't necessarily feel like it's a catch-all or that you can go watch one special or you can experience some kids' news and then think that after a couple conversations, you know, your kid will be on the path to whatever that looks like in doing and being an anti-racist. I feel that it's just the building blocks to start making these conversations and helping kids unpack traumatic events and not normalize it, but being sensitive and being able to make sure that you're touching base and connecting with that kid on what they're thinking, on their thoughts, and listening to them trying to figure out the world.
What can parents do? What are the resources outside of sitting down and watching the CNN Elmo special, for example? What should they be doing? Where are the resources? Is it books? Is it digital? Is it what is it, Jessica, in about a minute? And then, Bridget, I'll come to you.
Sure. I think books are the perfect place to start. A lot of times it takes the awkwardness out of putting the onus on the parent, and you can experience talking about sensitive topics through a character in the book. So whether that's sharing your feelings around how this person is experiencing the world, whether that's answering hard questions that your kid had, even saying that it's okay, saying that you don't have the answer, so maybe we need to think about it for a while. And then kids understand fair and unfair. So that's a totally appropriate age accessible way to make sure that you're connecting with them, that sometimes when Black people see a police officer, that scares them because they're treated unfairly. And then I would say as far as looking at tragedy as a whole and Black trauma and pain, Fred Rogers always said, look for the helpers. So the people that are, you know, donating to bail bonds, the people that are, you know, helping protesters put milk or water in their eyes, that's great to highlight to the kids that in times of tragedy, look for the people that are out here being kind and compassionate and caring.
Yeah, I think the number one message is for parents to not be silent and to not wait for the kids to bring it up, because the conversation may never happen. I absolutely agree with Jessica that books are great conversation starters, especially for the younger kids. I think for older kids, you can start bringing in news stories, how the content is portrayed, what's happening. And most of all, ask children what they think. Because sometimes it takes kids a while just to even process what they're thinking and just to become aware of what they're thinking. So ask them what they think. And over time, when you start having these conversations, the children will learn that this is an okay topic to talk about, and they will start asking the questions, and you can start having those conversations. I do think one website that has great resources is the Embrace Race organization. They do have book recommendations. There's a lot of webinars for parents, both parents of color and white parents, that can really help parents start having these conversations.
So many things to consider and talk about. Bridget Vitrup is a professor of childhood development at Texas Women's University, and Jessica Bratt is the youth services manager at Grand Rapids Public Library. Thanks to you both for this really important conversation.
Thanks for having me.
It was great to be part of the show.
And that's our show for today. You can continue sharing your thoughts with us at 877-8MYTAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.